Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Eight Worldly Concerns by Lama Adam Berner. Lama Adam teaches from a chapter of Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo's book, Into the Heart of Life. This teaching explores how attachment is the cause of our suffering, how we can spot attachment by being aware of the eight worldly concerns, and how cultivating openness and awareness can make our lives more workable. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
I will share this. So this is the prayer of refuge. And if you don't know it, that's okay. We're going to chant it. I think what we'll do is we'll chant it one time in Tibetan, one time in English, and then one time in Tibetan. And the idea here is, you know, we're generating this attitude of taking refuge in the right sources, the three jewels. And we'll talk a little bit more about kind of how about that today in the body of the talk. But we're also in the second half of this, we're setting our motivation. So we're not only like putting our hope in the right place, you know, but we're also making this aspiration that we're doing this not just for ourselves, but for others. So if you know the prayer, you can chant along. If not, you can just make the aspiration in your heart that our time today here will be a benefit to yourself and to all beings. O Sangye Chidang Tsuki Chodnana Tanchu Padu Dami Kapsuchi Daki Chin Tsuki Pesu Namki Jola Penchi Sangye Juparshu. In English? Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Noble Sangha. Through the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. Tibetan once more. Sangye chudang suki chudnam la janchu padu dami kapsu chi daki jin suki pe sunam ki Jola Pinchi Sangye Juparshu. Baden Sawe Lama Rinpoche, Daki Chimo Pede Denjula, Kadrin Chimbo Gondi Jason Ting, Kusum Tugin Jujup Sadusu. So, by the way, in case anyone's wondering, that little prayer that Lama Kathy and I and a lot of teachers say after that is a prayer to the Root Lama. And we're basically saying, precious and glorious Root Lama, abiding on the lotus and moon seat above my head, accept me with your great kindness. Please grant me the realization of your body, speech, and mind. So it's kind of a way for us to bring our teachers into the moment and hope for their support. So, like I said, like we should, at the beginning of a talk, it's always a good idea to generate bodhicitta, this mind of awakening, you know, and make the aspiration that our time here today will be a benefit to beings. And that in order to do so, we should make an effort to really be present in the moment and listen, with openness and awareness. This is stuff, I mean, we'll inevitably think about it while we hear it, but it's really best to try and kind of try to just listen and take it in. And then later on, for sure, contemplate it, you know, take some time to think about it and examine it and then to meditate too. So today's talk is based on a section of a book by Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo. And here's a picture. So she's a British woman who, when she was 18, found Buddhism and went to went to India and was ordained at age 21. She was actually one of the first Westerners to become a Buddhist monastic. And she is known best for, there's a book about her called Cave in the Snow, which is a fantastic book that I recommend to everybody. I read it because Marilyn gave it to me once and said, now just give it to somebody else when you're done. And I did that. I passed it on. So it's probably still making its way through the Dharma family right now. So she's pretty amazing. And here she is with His Holiness Karmapa. She's now the abbot of a nunnery called Dongyu Gatso Ling. And His Holiness Karmapa visited there a couple of years ago, I think around 2015 or something. So yeah, she did 12 years in solitary retreat. And the story of that is really something. So I highly recommend checking it out. Now, so we're going to be talking about the 8 worldly concerns today. These are them. I realize I can't look at my notes if I have the screen shared. So we're going to talk about this real quick, then I'm going to take it off the screen. So if you need to write them down, go ahead. What you'll see here is these pairs. Now, I put them in their easiest to remember format here, which is the rhyming format. But if you look at them in terms of like how they actually work out, like it would be more like pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and ill repute, right? Because like we want pleasure and we don't want pain. We want gain and we don't want loss. So, this is the way that in my head it's easiest to remember is if I can do the rhyming. So that's the subject today is the 8 worldly concerns. So, I like to start these kind of talks where I'm teaching from a book. I like to start just reading what the teacher says. And I like to finish that way too. And that's partially because if there's a bumpy ride in the middle, at least I know that there'll be a smooth takeoff and landing. So here's how she starts this chapter. This is a book called Into the Heart of Life. And so she says, and by the way, there's 3 words that kind of stuck out to me about this that I want you to kind of keep in your head as we go through this. And those words are attachment, awareness, and workability. Attachment, awareness, and workability. So Jitsuma Tenzin Palmo says, we are not generally aware of our appetite for praise and our dread of blame. We are not generally aware of how we yearn for a good reputation and fall anxious at the thought of the bad. We are not generally aware of the urgency of our desire for gain and our fear of loss. We are not generally aware of how much we gravitate towards what we regard as pleasurable, nor how much we try to avoid what we regard as painful. But it is these 8 worldly concerns that keep us revolving around and around in this cycle of birth and death, samsara. The 8 worldly concerns condition a great part of what we do and what we plan. They may even condition our spiritual practice. What underlies our reaching out for what seems good and pleasurable in this avoidance of what is not? What are we really looking for? What sort of peace do we hope to gain? We may hope to gain something from all the effort we put into trying to get and trying to avoid. But the very grasping that underlies our effort is precisely what holds us to this whole cycle of birth and death. We may even regard such grasping as pleasurable. This dynamic of motivation, of desire and aversion, hope and fear, keeps our ordinary egoistic preoccupations going. And we are not even conscious of it. We assume it's natural that we want pleasure and don't want pain. We assume it's natural to hope for gain and to fear loss. We don't question the very structure of this dualistic mindset, which is based on ignorance of our situation. So I'm going to take a kind of sideways turn here and talk briefly, since she brought up this situation. And I want to talk briefly about the 4 Noble Truths, because this is foundational to everything that we talk about and foundational to all schools of Buddhism. And I just want to make sure we're all familiar with this before we move on. So the Buddha his first teaching after he attained enlightenment was the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha said there are spoke these four truths, and what he said is that the first truth is suffering. Second truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. The third truth is the cessation of suffering, and the fourth truth is the path. So when he said the truth that there is suffering, that's an English translation that's actually not particularly accurate. The Sanskrit word is dukkha. And what we're really talking about here is dissatisfactoriness. We're talking about things not being quite right. It's this sense that things are always just not quite right. We're just, something's not in place. Something's not right, you know? And this does include bigger things. I mean, this can include the more gross ideas of suffering that we think of. But really, we're talking about that idea that things are not as we want them to be, you know? And it's not only the sense that things are now not as we want them to be. It's also this worry that they won't be how we want them to be later, you know, or will things be as nice as they are right now? You know, it's all of these things are dukkha. And the second truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. And the cause, according to the Buddha, is attachment. We could think of that like in an action word as like grasping or clinging or fixation. This is kind of the ways that our attachment manifests. And the good news about this is that if there's a cause of suffering, then if you remove the cause, then suffering will go away, right? And so, and if you want to do that, there's a way to do that, and that's the path. So the truth of the path refers to the Eightfold Noble Path, right speech, right livelihood. I don't remember them all. The easiest way to sum it up is do no harm, practice only virtue, totally tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. And that's a great little thing to remember. I always say it, but write it down, memorize it. Like if you can remember that, you remember everything you need to know, because all this other stuff we talk about is just elaborations on that theme. Do no harm, practice only virtue, totally tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So when we look at these two, they're actually two groups of two. So there's like the first two, the truth of suffering and the cause of suffering. Those are the effect and the cause of samsara. So samsara's characteristic is suffering. Like what's characteristic of samsara, the cycle of birth and death that we experience, is this dissatisfactoriness. That's its characteristic. Similarly, with the last two, the characteristic of nirvana is no suffering. There is no suffering. So one other thing I noticed the other day when I was looking at this is the truth of the path. There's a path we're on whether we decide to be Buddhist or know anything about Dharma at all. Like there's always, everybody's on a path. I'm thinking of, there's this Devo lyric from Freedom of Choice. If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. And so we are all on a path, whether we're deciding to be or not. The path to samsara is attachment. And that's frequently the path we're on, you know? So, but the path to enlightenment is this Eightfold Noble Path. Okay, yeah. So then the Buddha also said, so just to recap real quick. So we've got cause and result. The result being suffering, the cause being attachment, or no suffering, the cessation of suffering, is the result of the path. And then the Buddha also was, in the second time he said this, he actually repeated the Four Noble Truths three times. The second time he said it, he made clear what we're supposed to do with each of those. And the first Noble Truth, he said, understand, that the truth of suffering is to be understood. The cause of suffering is what is to be abandoned. The cessation of suffering is what is to be achieved. And the path is what is to be relied upon. And this is really important. Number one, because we generally try to abandon suffering without abandoning its cause. So generally, like we're actually causing suffering as we try to abandon it. And that's like one of the prime mistakes why we cycle in samsara, in this ocean of suffering, as we say. But the understanding suffering part is key, and that's where the eight worldly concerns figure in. That's part of this understanding suffering thing. because you can think about it in terms of like trying to fix something. Like if you're trying to, if something's wrong with your car, if you don't understand how the engine works, there's no way to try to figure out what's going wrong, you know? And so one of the reasons we say to understand suffering, to try to understand it, is because that's how, number one, you can figure out how to do it. And number two, you know that how, you know, like you have the motivation to do it. Like maybe an easier example is the toilet, right? Because like, sometimes the toilet's running and you're like, what is it? You know, and we've all taken the lid off and it's that little flippy thing isn't in place, right? You move the little flippy thing back or, you know, like, so, but you wouldn't, if you didn't know that that flippy thing was what makes the toilet run, you know, you wouldn't be able to fix it. So, Chuck, yeah, I think I knew that probably came from somewhere else. Chuck was saying that the Devo lyric is a well-known existentialism tenet. I knew that came from somewhere. Thank you. But yeah, so it's this trying to understand suffering. Like that's how we figure out how it works. Like there you go. Oh, okay. Well, that's the problem. The problem is the attachment, you know, and we only get there through really examining suffering and trying to understand it. It's not at all a sadistic thing, you know, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. So again, those three words, we'll step back on them: attachment, awareness, workability, you know? So when you notice attachment, you can apply awareness and then things become more workable. So the real problem here, when we say attachment is the issue, the core of that is an attachment to a misapprehension of what we are, a misapprehension of I or me. And this tendency to not see things as they really are is something that we see in almost everyone we meet. So we don't even question it. We identify with all these different things. We believe our opinions and our prejudices. And by doing so, we limit ourselves. Because according to Kenpo Sultan Jeltsin Rinpoche, there's lots of different sort of formulations of this. But the way he describes our true nature is as open, spacious, and relaxed. That's our true nature, is open, spacious, and relaxed. But when we cling on to things as identity, we start to close that world in. That openness begins to be sort of contained, and it gets to be a smaller and smaller world. And it's all these different things, like our opinions, our ideas. There's certain phrases that help, that are indicators of when we're doing that. Things like, well, I'm upset because I care about this, or I'm the kind of person who, or I don't like it when, you know, like all these little things that we identify as ourselves are barriers that are kind of walling us in, and they prevent us from seeing this true nature. And we frequently use I as the justification for all kinds of unfortunate behavior, acting out of all kinds, you know, acting out our attachment through I. And we justify it by thinking, well, I'm, you know, but this is me. I do this stuff. Like I'm the kind of person who, all that kind of stuff. So all Buddhist practice is directed at overcoming these notions, these misapprehension of the self. So I want to read another section from Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo. She says, we believe our opinions. We believe our prejudices. We believe in ourselves as solid and separate individual, me. I think this, I think that, in my opinion, we do it automatically. This sense of I, of a me, separate from everything else which is not me, which is other, is an expression of our primordial ignorance from a Buddhist point of view. All Buddhist practices are directed to overcoming such notions so that we may open up to a level of being that is much vaster than this tiny little ego we cling to so desperately. Clinging to the sense of I, we reach out through our greed and grasping for anything that will give apparent pleasure to this ego. At the same time, we try to push away anything that will give it pain. Aversion finds expression through anger, aggression, and negativity. We do it automatically. Maybe it's stirring in you right now. You sit on your cushion with an aim to have a nice meditation session, and in the beginning, it's quite comfortable. After a bit, your knees start to hurt in your back. And automatically you move to avoid the pain and bring back the pleasure, the comfort. Bringing desire and aversion even to our spiritual practice, we try to avoid anything which is not physically or mentally comfortable. Even though we may seem to be sitting on our cushion, we are tossed by the waves of samsara. It is the nature of waves to go up and come down. But of course, if you go and cling to the idea of going up, you must also accept the fact that you will come down. Everything is impermanent. From moment to moment, change reveals itself. Though we try endlessly to negotiate, something always seems to come along to smash whatever it is that we cling to. Endlessly, frantically, we try to get it back again. Our lives unfold like this. It is so normal, we don't question it. But until we begin to question it, until we begin to become more conscious of how we engage in this struggle all of the time, we cannot open to inner equanimity. And I made a little note in my book here. I wrote, true optimism. Because to me, this is what real optimism is this idea that we can have inner equanimity. But we have to examine this. We have to question the way we think about things. And that's how we can really achieve, you know, long-lasting happiness. Because in another section here, Jetsuma describes the eight worldly concerns as the eight worldly hang-ups. Because we're like hung up on them and we just can't get free of them. And part of the reason for that is because of hope and fear, or expectation and anxiety. According to the Buddha, we all are equal in our wish to be happy. And, you know, I think that's a pretty easy thing to come to understand. You know, nobody wants to suffer. We may have different ideas of what happiness is, but everybody's looking to be happy, all beings, including animals and all the other beings that we maybe can't see. So she also says here that we suffer when we live our lives as a form of resistance against things not going how we'd like them to. We suffer when we live our lives as a form of resistance against things not going how we'd like them to. So again, we all want to be happy, but when things maybe don't go how we plan, or they don't line up on that side of the column that is pleasure and gain and all that stuff, obviously that upsets us. And obviously it upsets us, you know, when we encounter pain and things like that. But kind of what we're really talking more about is all the time before and after those things happen, because that's really when hope and fear is at work. You know, is thinking about stuff that may happen or going to happen or did happen. And so part of the problem here is that we need to reframe what success is. You know, we need to reframe what winning is, because when we mistakenly seek for pleasure and gain and things like that and devote a lot of our headspace, our thinking and our mind towards examining that stuff, thinking about getting pleasure, thinking about getting fame, all those things, thinking, boy, I hope I don't have any loss or I don't have any pain, you know, it's basically like the defects of samsara right there. You know, we're kind of like, it's like the extended jam, the worldly concerns are the extended jam of the defects of samsara, you know, because we're measuring success against this yardstick of samsara. You know, like in the, you know, this is how samsara works, you know, pleasure and pain. So we're not going to win samsara. Like, you can't hack samsara, you know, but we know the characteristic of samsara is suffering. And knowing that, like, we need to strive towards enlightenment. And the way to do that is the path. It's not attachment. You know, it's the Eightfold Noble Path that we talked about. So this may sound all kind of like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Like, how can I ever do that? There's all these things in my life and they're upsetting. And we all experience that. We all go through that. But the Buddha taught that there are two types of suffering. There's physical suffering and there's mental suffering. The physical aspect, physical suffering, is inevitable. And the example of that is the Buddha's own aging and death. The Buddha grew old, he got sick, and he died. And in fact, there are, you know, when there's in the iconography of the Buddha's death and when he died, it's usually like he's surrounded by humans and gods and all kinds of beings weeping, you know, like just really upset. Like, so these things happen, you know, like it's not to say that we have to be heartless, you know, or not experience things. But we can train the mind so it does not suffer even when the body does. That is possible. And life is stressful, you know, life has always been stressful, particularly now it may seem extra stressful, you know, but we add all this additional stress continually through hopes and fears, thinking about stuff, worrying about stuff, when 90% of what we worry about never even happens. So we have this idea that like, this mistaken idea that samsara ought to be happy for us. But that's not what the Buddha said. You know, the Buddha said samsara, you know, its characteristic is dissatisfaction. It's this characteristic is the suffering. That's why we need to try to follow the path so we can achieve enlightenment. So the point here is not the pain or the loss or the criticism. The point is our aversion to it. That's where the suffering comes from. Similarly, it's not the pleasure, the gain, or the praise. It's our attachment to those things. That's where the suffering comes from. If we're able to just open ourselves to what is happening in the moment, there's no problem. Again, attachment, increase your awareness, and then things become workable. And so how do we work with these eight worldly concerns? Particularly, how do we find them, you know? Well, they're everywhere with us. We take them everywhere. They're in our work, in our friendships, and our family, and even in our Dharma centers. And that situation is what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism, which is a really great term, you know? And I want to read a little more from Jitsuma. She says, egoism can easily take hold of our spiritual practice. We may study the Dharma, do practices, and go to teachings and retreats, but all can become means to enhance this sense of I. I am a spiritual person. I have read so many Buddhist books. I have met all the best lamas. I have received all the main empowerments. I do important things at my Dharma center. I am special. It is really up to us to question and honestly look at our mind. One Catholic priest I know said that we are like pieces of rough wood. If we always stroke ourselves with silks and velvet, that's very nice, but we don't become smooth. In order to become smooth, you need sandpaper. The so-called difficulties and problems that we meet with in our daily lives are as sandpaper and make us smooth. This is how we learn. This is how we really measure ourselves and grow up. Underneath, we can see how intolerant we are toward ourselves. Caught by our self-judgments and prejudices, we have this picture of how we should be. But when things don't fit in, this creates a lot of distress, anxiety, and tension, a lot of desire and aversion, hope and fear. Instead of being swept up by the eight worldly concerns, we can cultivate our ability to be present and mindful. We can learn to step back and become aware of our thoughts and emotions as they arise and discern that they are just thoughts and emotions. They are not me and mine. We can become more open and adaptable. Instead of identifying totally with our hopes and fears, our ideas and thoughts, we can see that they are just empty phenomena which arise for a moment and then disappear. So it's this ability to be fully present and seeing thoughts and feelings as feelings that really makes us master of our minds. And we start working with that in shamatha. So, you know, and if you've had an interest, if you've had an intro to meditation class, or, you know, if you remember back to when you first learned to meditate, the first point really is beginning to recognize that our minds are out of control. The analogies that the Buddha used is of a wild monkey, or my favorite, a drunken elephant in heat. So these were the Buddha's assessments of our untamed minds. And this was you know, 2,600 years ago. This was before TV and the internet and before social media. So I can't imagine what those analogies would be today, but I don't know what's more wild than a drunken elephant in teeth, but I think there's probably something, and we are it. So our mind is the issue here is that our mind is always with us, and it's how we experience everything. There's no nothing. There's no sensory input we get without our mind. There's no thought that we have without our mind, and it's the method by which we experience everything. So we take it everywhere. We can't escape from it, and usually it's out of control, and this is tragic. So like when we sit down in meditation, the first thing we see is that we have all these thoughts that we didn't even realize were there. And as we practice, we start to realize that not only how thoughts arise, but how we tend to cling on to them and then fixate on them, you know, and spend and kind of get carried away by them. We don't even realize we're doing this until we start to sit there and increase our awareness through shamatha. And it's with shamatha, as we practice that, that we become better able to realize that thoughts are thoughts and feelings are feelings. Our thoughts are not me. Our thoughts are not, you know, our true nature. These things kind of come and they go away. And we don't realize that before. We think that, for instance, like we think if something, and when I say thoughts, I'm also talking about when things happen and we think about them, when we process them. It's not just inner stuff. This is also interacting with external things. So, for instance, like we think that if something happens, we generally think it's either good or bad or neutral. And then with that thought comes attachment or aversion or ignorance. And we think that those things kind of happen at the same time. When we're not looking closely, it looks to us like when something happens, what happens with it is the attachment or the aversion. But it's through practicing meditation that we begin to see that, like, we actually think the attachment and the aversion. And we actually, whether we realize it or not, we're making a choice usually to follow those ideas of attachment or aversion. And it's working through meditation. It's such a simple thing, like, that really the instructions for shamatha, it's a very profound practice, but the instructions seem almost deceptively simple. You know, how you just place your attention on the breath. And when you realize you're thinking, you bring your attention back to the breath. But it's that process that begins to open up this way of realizing that that our thoughts are not us. That's not our identity. And that we do have a choice about what we follow, you know, which thoughts we follow and which thoughts we are carried away by, you know, and where we want to put our attention and our awareness. So we spend... That helps us to see that we spend so much of our time in our regular life on our outer conveniences, you know, kind of trying to arrange the furniture of life to try to get it perfect. But what we really should be working on is the mind, because it's the mind that helps to determine our experience. And a common analogy for that is like when you think of like rich people or people who have everything they could possibly want. There's a lot of those people that are miserable, you know, like it seems like they have all these things. They would have to be happy, but like we can probably think of several people right now that we know of that are just very unfortunately upset people, you know? And then on the flip side, there's people who have nothing and are filled with love and joy and generosity. And, this example shows that it's not the external circumstances that determine, you know, our happiness. And one thing that Tenzin Palmo says here is that the state of our mind is where we dwell. So we have to cultivate a more peaceful and centered and equanimous mind. Equanimous meaning that whatever happens, we can deal with it. We don't have to manipulate everything to our satisfaction. So... these attachments, we're so trained, you know, it's very habitual, all these attachments. We've been doing this for a long, long, long time. If you are someone who believes in rebirth, like we've been doing this for countless lifetimes. If you don't, your entire life still, you've been sort of feeding this habit of attachment. And the way to start to undo that is to increase your awareness. like to meet attachment with open awareness. And that's what we do. The best way to start to cultivate that is with meditation. And then, all the suffering, experiences of suffering, things like that, like they're probably not just going to instantly go away for us. What you and I will probably experience is more like, things become more workable and they gradually become more and more workable. And that's the effect that we experience. And that's the sign that we're on the right path, that we're doing the right thing. You know, on the flip side, that's definitely a way I realize if my practice is lacking. You know, if you're somebody who started meditating and then you stop for a while, you usually notice that things become a little more overwhelming. It's a little harder to deal with stuff. Whereas when you're not as wrapped up in your thoughts and your feelings and your hopes and your fears, you can really just think more precisely about situations that need to be solved somehow or another. We're able to more clearly just deal with the situation, work with it, you know, because everything in some way is workable. But we frequently don't see that. That's part of our delusion about I and our delusion about these eight worldly concerns, you know, like thinking we need pleasure and we don't need pain, and spending so much time wrapped up in that. So really, I think this is all like a description of what a real model for optimism really is. And like you said, I want to finish with Jetsuma Tenzin Palmo's words. This is the end of this section on the Eight Noble Truths. She says, people think that the Buddha was pessimistic because he spoke first about the unsatisfactoriness of our ordinary everyday experience. But he didn't leave it there. He didn't merely say, oh, well, life is suffering, bad luck. He spoke of why it is suffering. Our everyday life is composed of suffering because we grasp. We hold on so tightly, and yet everything is impermanent. Ultimately, what we hold on to so tightly will change. It is not things which are the problem. It is our grasping mind. We need to allow for meaning in our lives. That is, we need to get our own mind and life together. In this way, we can benefit the most people as well as ourselves. All the problems that really come into this world, apart from natural disasters, are caused by human beings. We cause endless problems with our out-of-control minds. Wisdom and compassion are desperately needed, and yet they dwell right within our own minds. They can't be bought. We need challenges in this world, and we have to cultivate qualities which in themselves cannot be cultivated unless we are faced with challenges. Far from being setbacks for our spiritual path, challenges are the spiritual path. We must develop an attitude which is open and which takes everything we meet and uses it. If things go wrong, if people are difficult, we cultivate patience and compassion. If people are in need, we cultivate generosity. The Buddha said that to practice the Dharma is to be as a fish swimming upstream. Now, swimming upstream is a very lonely journey. You might ask yourself, is it worth the time and effort to swim upstream when everybody else is going down with the current? But it is those who can swim upstream who can reach the source. So if we want to do something meaningful with this lifetime, then the place to start is right where we are. And the only time to start is right now, in this moment. It is the only time we have. The future is just an idea. The past is gone. And the moment is flowing. Like this. The most valuable thing we have in our life is our mind. We can cultivate it. We can learn how to use our mind skillfully. At the moment, this very precious jewel called a mind is covered with the thick casing of the mud of the eight worldly concerns. And we have to wash it clean so the jewel can sparkle again. We cannot say, I don't have time, when every single breath we take, we are conscious, is an expression of our practice. So, I have time for questions and comments.
What was the name of the book again?
Into the Heart of Life.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is one of those books that is a collection of a bunch of her talks, you know, so it's a bunch of different topics. Anyone else have any questions or thoughts?
Could you address more specifically the 8 worldly concerns? I mean, just a little.
Like what each are?
Well, just, you know, how, what keeps them going or how they affect us.
Yeah. So, thank you. That's a good question. So, we have this sort of fundamental ignorance, and really what that is, like I said, this nature is actually open, spacious and relaxed. That's what our true nature is really like. But at some point, that it's said that we got overwhelmed by this openness. And in doing so, we started to think of a self and another. We sort of created this illusion of self and other. And then because of that, because that duality arose, you know, from what was just open, spacious, and relaxed, then we started to, you know, think of self and other. So when we experience other, we tend to experience it as either good, bad, or neutral. Like, and it's what we call, feeling. So we have this feeling of good, bad, or neutral. And then in reaction to that, we, either give rise to attachment or aversion. Or if it's neutral, ignorance. And ignorance not just in the sense of like not knowing, but like literally like ignoring. You know, which is why we talk about awareness and applying awareness, because like the opposite of ignoring is being aware, you know, like cultivating this awareness. So in giving rise to awareness and attachment, like the most common ways we see those come up are these fears of these 8 worldly concerns. You know, we're attached to pleasure and gain and things like that. Those are the ways that we can most frequently see attachment and aversion arising. Attachment is usually the word we use, but aversion is kind of a form of that, right? Because like it's being attached to not wanting something. So each of these, so if you've got this sort of fundamental ignorance, and then depending on whether we think it's good or bad, we're going to act with either attachment or aversion. And usually it's some form of either pleasure or pain or loss or gain. And so those are the most frequent. So it's kind of like we could say, just try to give up attachment, but we have a hard time recognizing our attachments because we're so habitually wrapped up in them. And like she said in the beginning about how a lot of times we even look at our grasping as pleasurable, you know, because a lot of times we grasp at these things that are in the samsaric sense pleasurable, or they are like gains and stuff, but we become attached to those things. So I think the 8 worldly concerns are sort of a signpost to a way to a marker to catch, you know, when these attachments and aversions are arising. And in particular, these pleasure and pain, loss and gain, irrepute, fame, praise and blame. These are usually things that, they're not specific instances usually we're talking about, but they're the ways that we spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. You know, like we spend a lot of time when things aren't actually happening. So you may be working on something in your house and hit your thumb with a hammer. There's physical pain, obviously. But maybe you're someone that like, you know, you got a hammer something later today and you hurt your thumb, you know, one of the last time you were hammering. So you spend a half hour putting off hammering because, you know, you could hit your thumb, you know, and like that's a whole, you know, half hour of time spent worrying. You know, and like we said, all these worries and hopes, a lot of them never even happen. So a lot of these worldly concerns are you know, ways that we can catch these things happening in our mind stream throughout our day, even if something in particular isn't happening externally. You know, we engage in these 8 worldly concerns. Does that help, Patricia? Good.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for that question. Is that's any time we can rephrase stuff like that, that's helpful to me and to everybody. Any other questions?
I just have a comment.
Sure.
I remember in the book when she got out of 12 years retreat in that cave in the mountains, she asked her teacher, should I keep on, being in retreat, or should I go out and do, something? And he says, you should go out. He said, well, you could stay in your cave, but he says, or you could go form a nunnery and be polished like a pearl. Because when she's among other people, she's going to get stuff to work with more.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Thank you for reminding me. It's been a long time since I read it. But again, that book is Cave in the Snow. So that's another great one to read. It's a biography of her life. Thank you, Marilyn. Anyone else?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to say real quick, I've been to a lot of talks at KTC and have tried to help out as much as I can. But I just wanted to say that, and sorry, my video, I'm not really video ready right now, otherwise I would be on video, but I just want to say that I really enjoyed your talk today, and I thought that it was really, really helpful. I've been studying Buddhism on my own and with friends for about 8 years now, and I just thought that your talk today was one of the clearest articulations of some of the most basic principles and most important principles that have helped me in my everyday life. And I think that it could be a great talk for KTC to use moving forward for other people who are new and just want like a basic. You probably need at least some understanding of Buddhism probably before, I wouldn't have been able to understand it when I first started listening, but 8 years in anyway, I was able to understand. So I just want to share that and say thank you to Lama Adam for a really great talk today.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate it. And this and all the Dharma talks are on the YouTube page. So like if you ever want to stop back or see any of this stuff, they're always recorded and go up on the KTC YouTube page. But I'm really glad to hear that, Scott. Thank you. Like my teacher, Kempo Carter Rinpoche and Lama Kathy and Lama Tom and His Holiness Karmapa, like I really just feel like I'm playing their songs, and hopefully somewhat well. So thank you. I really appreciate that. And,
great. It was amazing. It was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Anyone else? If not, so I want to say thank you all. I was really looking forward to talking about this. When I read that section of her book, I really liked the way she talked about the eight worldly concerns. I feel like when I first read it, I was like, wow, this is such a different take on the eight worldly concerns. And now I've been so immersed in it, reading it and studying it, that like I kind of forget why it was so different. But I know it struck me as like really a unique way of talking about them. So I hope that I was accurate, and I hope that I said stuff that helps people. And if I said anything that doesn't jive with your view of Dharma or made you in any way doubt the teachings, that's entirely my own fault, and I apologize for that. Again, I try to do my best to share what my teachers taught me and rejoice in their Dharma activity, and we pray that they remain and continue to teach. And so let's dedicate the merit of our time today, again, in the hopes that we can attain Buddhahood, so we bring all beings to perfect enlightenment. By this merit, may all beings attain the omniscience of Buddhahood and defeat our common enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. May we free all beings. May we free all beings. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.